Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play dude.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
Here we go, sort of on time this week.
Yeah, whatever that is these days.
I don't even know. Honestly, when you texted me today about, hey, are we doing the pod? I'm like, oh yeah, we do the pod on Thursdays now. But yeah, here we are. It's time for another toy department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. How are you today, sir?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Everyone around here is getting healthier, which is good. My child is walking, which, you know, is an exciting accomplishment, and then you immediately realize your life is over. So I'm processing
because they're mobile.
That. Yeah, and I mean he's already very mobile. His crawling is elite, but just the fact that he's starting to toddle around is scary.
So did this happen? These steps happen during quarantine? Were you there for the moment? So
well,
that's pretty cool.
He's taken some, you know, 2-3 steps at a time. His preferred style of movement at the moment is like 3 steps and a dive, you know, to get to his destination.
Same, to be honest.
Yeah, true. Mm. So I had seen that a few times, but he took a nice, like, legit 5-step all by himself walk for the first time yesterday, and I did not see it. I caught the video later.
Well, there was video. I guess that's good.
Yes, he's super into this basketball that he has right now, and tossing it around about 5 feet from him can get him to walk towards you. So it's relatively easy to reproduce.
Oh, that's good.
Yep.
You got him Eurostepping already?
Yeah. No, he's going to have all the moves. Right now, his main move is grabbing the ball and putting it as close to in his mouth as he can.
Oh, also same.
Yeah.
have you watched any of that 2K competition that ESPN has been playing?
No, I'm interested enough to go, huh, interesting, and then not watch it.
Yeah, I caught about 5 minutes today and was like, what am I doing? What am I doing with my life?
I think I saw like 400,000 people is the average viewership for that, which a lot of like lesser TV shows would be pretty pleased with at this point.
Yeah, I would say 400,000 captive people is probably the best way to go with that.
Yeah, no, that's what's happening. But nevertheless, people are watching.
Yes, yes, they are. All right, should we jump into Top Chef? That's the most recent thing that was on.
Okay, right? Let's do it.
We just watched it tonight.
Yep.
Just to give you a fantasy update, I'm now down to 1 player, 3 weeks into the competition. 4 weeks into the competition? Yeah, whatever we are. I have
one. I think this was 4.
Yeah, I have 1 player left, so it's not looking good for me.
I felt for you there, too, because as the show ended, I did not think it was Lisa. I really didn't. I thought for sure Malarkey or Leanne was going home after they screwed each other up and threw each other under the bus.
It did seem like Hummuscate was going to take one of them down.
Yeah, but also Malarkey's boring the Caprese salad didn't do him any favors either. But... Lisa, like, I don't know. It seemed like they were nitpicking in general this episode for the elimination, and in particular with Lisa, like, it just felt like they zeroed in on the Brussels sprout thing and were just like, forget about it.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, she made some cookie mistakes, right? And that's
yep.
you know, if they start picking nits and you didn't cook your food well, then you're probably, there's a good chance you can go home. You know what I mean? That's historically the way it's been in this competition. I'm just wondering, like, how many episodes is Leanne going to be in the bottom three? Like, she's 4 for 4, I think, right?
Yeah, she's not good. Like, this was proof positive. Because not only was she not good, but she did all of the things with her personality that make her so unlikable to me. Like, when
you,
they
you really do you really do dislike her.
I really do. I feel like. When they criticized her dish, the first thing she did was say, that was the part I didn't do. And then when Malarkey tried to throw her under the bus back, she was like, oh, how could you? What kind of person? How dare you? Like, come on.
But it's saying, like, that was the part I didn't do. Like, that's not really throwing someone under the bus. Because
neither is – well, then
– You know that's not the part I did is not going to get you out of being responsible for the dish, right?
I guess, you know what I mean? She certainly seemed to be trying. I just don't understand how that's different from what Malarkey said when it's like, okay, but they also said the hummus wasn't good, lady. I just, like, it's – they're both trying to save themselves. And fine, it's a game. But, like, the woe is me. How could you throw me under the bus like that? Look at the tire tracks on my back. It's like, come on, calm down.
Yeah. Well, and one would also think, like, when you've been on the bottom 4 times in a row.
Right.
Have some humility. And I don't know, like, I mean, I don't have an encyclopedic run through of the quick fires, but I feel like she's been on the bottom of most of those too.
She's just not doing it this season. For whatever reason, it's not happening for her.
And yet, still here.
Yep. I think, you know, the standout takeaway for me here is that just Melissa is peaking. And I just hope she's not peaking too soon because I'm really enjoying her.
I think that there is – I'm enjoying her too, by the way. She's been cooking fabulously, and she's good television besides that. Like, she's got some pretty good lines.
Totally.
I feel like there's an elite strata of chefs. There are 5 chefs that have separated themselves, and the winner is almost certainly going to be from one of those 5. Would you agree with this?
You have 5 chefs. Let me try to guess who they are.
Okay. Well, why don't you just say your 5 chefs, and I'll see if we agree.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So if I had to pick 5, I think clearly Eric, clearly Melissa. Clearly Gregory. Kevin has to be on there. So is that 4? Melissa, Eric, Gregory, Kevin, and I think Voltaggio, I guess, would be the other one, although he continues to play the middle. Like, he really has not had an explosive week.
Yeah, I do sort of feel like he's mostly been lying in wait.
Yeah. Are those the 5, though, that you had?
You know, now that I think about it, maybe I screwed up. Maybe I have 4. I didn't have Eric. I didn't have Eric in that group. And the other 4 I did have, and I'm trying to think of
was who it was Karen? There. Who was the other... Karen would have been my last out in that.
It's not Karen. All right, so Voltaggio, Gregory, Kevin.
And Melissa.
Melissa. Yeah, I think that's it. I don't know if there's any other one.
Karen, come on. Eric, and even I think you could have reasonably put, well, maybe not. Stephanie and Nini have also done some really good things, though.
Yes, yes. But to me, it seems like those first 4, I guess, are more talented than the others. Right.
I would put Eric in there for sure.
I think Eric's really good. To me, he's next level down. But
that sounds about right. And if the 4 was Melissa, Gregory, Kevin, and Voltaggio, three of those four, along with Eric, were all on the blue team, which explains yes. why when they went to the judges' table, Padma was like, one team very clearly won the progressive menu challenge.
those teams, that was like the, you know, when you're playing pickup and you're like, well, at least this will be quick and then maybe we can shoot for yeah. teams again.
let's get some exercise here, fellas. No, it really was. And Malarkey said it too, but it really was.
Yep. And that's sort of what it became clear to me. I'm like, oh, well, minus Voltaggio, it's like all the chefs you'd want are over there on that column.
Yeah. And like we're saying, even if you don't have Eric or Karen in that final group, they've both been really good, and Jen is still terrifying. So that whole team was a hammer.
Yeah, it's like the rest of that team. You know, yeah, it was not at all a shock to me that they won. Although it sounds like they actually pretty much like the red team's dishes for the most part.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, everyone here is clearly really good at what they do. A quick note on the quickfire: the trolls thing was very dumb, but also the color. Like, what it ended up producing for a quickfire, I thought was really cool. Like, these elaborate multicolored dishes. Gregory's soup looked like the winner from the very beginning, so that was not a surprise.
I agree that, like, I wasn't surprised when he won, and certainly the way that they tasted it, but, yeah. like... If you'd have said to me at the beginning of that quickfire that a plantain-based soup was going to take it, I would have been like, I don't know, but my money's on the ice cream.
Yeah, but the ice cream looked like garbage and was a terrible idea.
Like,
and once again, Malarkey's just – it's incredible that Malarkey in this quickfire that is supposed to be a little more simple goes so far over the top, and then when you have all these – tremendous vegetables to play with and they want you to do something creative, he comes up with a burrata caprese. Like, it's just the opposite of everything. He really is a goof too. But quickly on the quickfire, I was shocked that both lined up next to each other visually and also apparently to taste, Kevin and Voltaggio went head to head on ceviche and Kevin whooped his ass.
Yeah.
That was surprising to me. And then also...
I thought Kevin's dish in the elimination challenge, I thought was really impressive looking
yeah, me
as
too.
Well.
Me too. Mm. I also think... shout out to Lisa, although she did get eliminated. The fact that she took the swing with like a cotton candy sauce on a steak in the quickfire and it seemed to work out well, that was pretty dope.
Yeah, I agree. Some of her better cooking, I thought.
Yeah.
One more thing about that quickfire. I said last week that the show had been setting new heights in product placement. Like they would. This
they
was
said,
the
hold
most
my,
insane. Yes.
They said, "Hold my troll."
Like, and like you said, it turned into a decent food challenge. But my God, that clip.
Rough.
Like,
yeah. We even saw a preview for the movie. Like they didn't, yeah. Like they weren't then going to show it in the commercial break.
Like you could, it's like you could just see the strings of like, well, we'll give you Kelly Clarkson, but you got to show a special sneak yep. preview of the. Like...
We need at least 38 seconds of Trolls World Tour the movie.
Right, and then we're gonna cut to the chefs reacting and like it's the greatest thing when you know that none of them has seen a troll movie or gives a shit.
Well, right, with the exception of like whoever's kids love it, right?
Right. Do kids love trolls? Is that a thing?
I don't know.
Are the trolls movies popular?
Malarkey. Malarkey said, "Look, the general rule is if they make a bunch of them, it's because they're popular."
Yeah, I guess that's true. somebody sees an opportunity.
Yeah.
By the way, I also wrote this down on the quickfire. Maybe my favorite moment of that quickfire was when Kelly Clarkson said that Voltaggio shrimp was mushy.
Yes.
he's like, okay.
Well, what I did like about Kelly Clarkson is like
so much.
Her reaction is what I think everyone's reaction would be, which is like, holy shit, all this food is so good. you know?
Yes.
Like, I can only imagine being in that room. Like, everything must just taste spectacular. Even the weird, bad stuff.
I'm assuming you've had that sort of, like, well, what if I got to eat this food and be a judge on Top Chef? Like, you've had that daydream.
Sure,
right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
You know.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that I'd have really insightful criticism, but I think it would just be like, oh, my God.
Exactly. That's exactly my thought process. I would like to be able to talk about whether or not your dish tells a story. What did Gail said something incredible today. I can't remember what it was, but it was some line like that about, like, I just don't feel like this tells a story, or you know what I mean? Where it's just like, I don't know how you come up with that. I understand what you're saying. But, like, I think in reality, I would just be like, God damn it, this one's so good.
Well, I think, you know, anytime you're talking about food telling a story, I think a lot of times you're telling a story. You know what I mean? As the person who is, like, judging whether that food told a story or not. Like,
sure, but you know what I mean.
You have a dish on a plate. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
they say things like, you know, this dish lacked perspective. You know what I mean? And it's like,
yeah.
And, like, I kind of understand what they're saying, but also I don't think I would be able to produce that sort of commentary.
Do you have a sense of, like, the salt, fat, acid, heat balances that are necessary that they oftentimes they talk about, like?
I at least understand. You know what I mean? I can. Mm-hmm. I know when food is too salty or too acidic or what have you. Like, that makes taste sense to me. I'm not sure I'd be able to properly balance a dish myself, but
no.
I get what they're saying. And I feel like if I tasted it, I would taste what they're talking about.
Yeah, that I get. I did feel like they used actually a little bit more audience commentary in this episode than a lot of episodes.
Yeah, and it was incredible that even the audience was like, the red team served us two plates of raw vegetables to start the meal. What's going on there?
Yeah. Although I'm gonna guess that was some precise editing to find that particular audience comment.
I think they probably saw a lot of son of a bitch before they got to that.
How about all them veggies?
By the way, Last Chance Kitchen, your girl's still alive, you know? You never know.
Yes, eliminated my guy in the process.
Yeah, well,
you know,
you were in a spot there. I thought Joe was going to pull it out for a second, but it was really a challenge that was much more catered to Lisa. And I have to say, I liked Joe Sasto the first time around, but he definitely the first time around read a little more like cocky. And his on-camera things, I think, have just been a delight this season.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to miss
He's
that.
Been really good at making fun of himself,
yes.
too, I feel like.
Like,
you know what I mean?
Like, what am I going to do? I think I'm going to go cook some pasta.
This is great. But I feel like I was actually like 3 or 4 meals since he got to make pasta, right?
Yeah,
like,
totally. I want to eat that guy's pasta, though, for sure. I mean, it must be spectacular.
I do too. He did live in San Francisco for a while, right? Like,
I believe
he
was
there for.
Yeah, I believe he had already left by the time he was on the first season, though. His first season, I should say.
I think that's true. Yeah. So haven't had a chance to taste any of those pastas.
No. No. Sad story.
Yeah, I had higher hopes for Joe. I still think he got a little bit screwed in episode 1. And it's just it's to Last Chance Kitchen your way past 12 chefs is a titanic order. And so I can't fault anybody for doing that. And, you know, no offense to Lisa, but she's not going to be 10 either. You know what I mean? It's just too early.
Yeah.
It's just too early. And there's going to be too many good people. You know, someone from that elite group is going to get eliminated earlier than they should. Cause that's just the way the show goes. Right. And, you know, maybe a restaurant wars or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What'd you think of the Padma's Angels gimmick?
I mean, it was dumb, but I enjoyed it.
I was like, I thought for sure one of them was going to be going home, that they were going to break up the Angels, which is why they started with that bit. But no, I guess not. Guess those Angels cooked just enough.
Yeah, all three of them were pretty safe. I mean, Nini kind of messed up the gnocchi in the quick fire, but her dessert was phenomenal.
Yeah. I think she might have been the best cook on that team, save maybe Voltaggio.
Yeah, could be. Could be. She's really good.
But yeah, I don't know that she's quite good enough to crack that group that we were talking about. Whereas like Eric, I could see that argument for sure.
So I think Joe Sasto's mostly a private chef now. So maybe you know, next time we're in LA, we could order a Sasto meal.
Yeah, Joe, if you're listening, come cook for us.
Pretty affordable.
Yes, we'll stand 6 feet away from you at all times.
Yeah, no, safety first.
Right. Who knows when private chefs will be able to do private chef things again?
Oh wait, hold on. Now I'm seeing maybe he's actually at a restaurant called Tanto C in L.A.
Tanto C. Okay, yeah.
Translates to so much yes in Italian. Inspired by combining the tradition of Korean banchan and the feeling you get sitting down for a meal in your Italian grandmother's kitchen. Small plates.
Small plates? Mm-hmm. I don't feel like that's what you get sitting down in your Italian grandmother's kitchen.
Small plates, all building up to the main event, a progression of handcrafted pastas.
By the way, did you understand, before we get off the Top Chef, I didn't really understand what makes a progressive six-course meal. Is it just that it flows well?
Right. I don't understand how it is totally separated from a regular six-course meal. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Joe Sasto also has traveling underground cannabis pop-ups.
Of course he does.
Here's a quote. To me, the food will always come first and be the focus, and cannabis is in turn another ingredient used to highlight and enhance the food, the people, and dishes being served, not the other way around.
Oh, man. Wow.
Joe Sasto. I'm in love.
You know, from a fantasy Top Chef perspective, picking him first did not work out for me, but I still have no regrets.
No, yes. I stand by your choice, man.
I'll ride the Sasto, man.
Hell yeah.
Sure. Hell yeah. All right, should we jump to the challenge?
Yes.
I got to say, this episode, were you a 90210 watcher back in the day? You were, right?
No, I'm a little young.
This one was like the equivalent of one of those episodes that revolves around like Ian Ziering. You know what I mean? Like,
well, I know what that means without watching Beverly Hills 90210. Yeah. And like, it ain't good, folks. It ain't good.
Yeah. You like to see Steve Sanders show up and do things, but you don't really want him to have to carry the episode.
It's so funny you said that, because there were so many times during this, and it wasn't a bad episode per se, but there were definitely numerous times where I was like, man, I'm getting a lot of like Swaggy C and D and Bailey in these, what's it called? IFCs, except that's not it.
ITMs.
ITMs. Why am I not seeing more Wes and Bananas? And like, where the hell was Nani all episode long? Is she just upset because Asaf got eliminated?
She is nursing her wounds.
She's just crushed over Asaf.
I don't know if you noticed the episode title.
No.
But it was Sweet Dreams Are Made of D.
Woof.
A lot of D. A lot of D.
A lot of D. And like a lot of D. I don't know, you don't even know how to describe it. Talking herself up in a way that it's just like it rings very false.
Yeah. No disrespect to D, who I enjoy.
I like D.
She's a champion. You know what I mean? Like, I have generally have warm feelings around D, but I think we've also learned that when D talks about how she feels about something, you cannot trust it.
No, she's clearly lying. She lies through her teeth constantly about how she feels. And the way you know is that she's constantly contradicting herself. Constantly.
Yes, constantly. And then that little showdown with Jen, with Deep 2.0, that's delightful. Delightfully hilarious.
And it's also, it's such a punch down by D. Like, and again, you're telling on yourself, right? Because you're like, I'm the big shit. I'm a defending champion. Can't nobody mess with me. But you're all freaking out over some rookie who's obviously going to get thrown in anyway because she talked to Rogan, who you are not boning right now. Like, I don't understand what's happening.
And supposedly not trying to bone, but like, yeah. Right. Like, and it was all just like why, you know, even Tori was like, move on.
Tori's ITM about that was great. She's like, I don't understand what's going on here. I just need her to move the hell on. Like, I just need her head in the game right now. I don't know why this is happening.
Because those people get it. Those people get it.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy the West Bananas, hey, here's the speech you should give?
That was the best part of the That was the best part of the episode, followed closely by Jordan being Jordan, which was incredible throughout. Like, the fact that, first of all, there is not a worse sport, perhaps, in the history of the challenge than Jordan. And it's born 100% out of him truly vociferously believing that he's so much better at everything than everyone. That, like, you finished third, dog. It's not that bad. Like, you were right there, and you had to go first in the airdrop. Like, sometimes you lose, but to him it's just like, I lost to these horrible idiots. I can't believe what a failure I am. And so he just throws a temper tantrum like a child and then continues to throw that temper tantrum like in slow motion throughout the episode.
Yeah, no, he wasn't really over it even by the time the episode ended.
No, because at the very end he's like, I'm still pissed.
And I kind of think he's gonna try to carry a little grudge against D, which is interesting since Tori, sure, I think, is still trying to be an ally there. So,
well, Tori's in a position where she basically just like all she does is Jordan damage control. I mean, she also slays challenges, don't get me wrong, she's a hell of a competitor, but mostly in terms of political game, it's just Jordan damage control all the time. So,
yeah.
Like,
I mean, the good cop, bad cop analogy is not, it's not all that far off, right?
No, although it's more like drunken idiot followed by apologist than it is bad cop followed by good cop, you know? And I'm not, Jordan is not drunk. He's just,
he's drunk on competition.
He's such a dick. And I love him on TV, and I don't hate his dickishness, but he is such a dick.
Yeah, and he is like, you can tell there is a not entirely television dislike of him among some people on that cast. You know what I mean?
100%.
Like, there's just a like, that guy's a dick. Yeah,
right. Like, there's just like a, I don't understand why he has to be such a cock all the time. Like, yep. you can see that feeling on a lot of people's faces talking to him.
Yep. And I think the longer you've been in the game, the more likely you are to feel that way, right? So
maybe, although I do think some of the guys have a certain grudging respect, just knowing that, you know, obnoxious as he may be, he's very good.
Oh, they all respect him because, as Tori said memorably, he's maybe the sickest to ever do it.
Yeah. Yep. he's up there.
You gotta give it up for that.
No doubt.
Do you buy the argument that that D owed them something for last year?
You know, yes, and I buy the argument philosophically. But I think we all know that's not how this works, right?
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think that they were just, you know, trying to get what they could there.
Yeah, I mean, they're pulling out all the stops to try to get Tori an easy win. But the real fraud of this is D. Because after all that, I mean, everyone said it. It's no mystery. Every single character on the show said it. How you could stir up such a fuss over this woman who clearly
Minnow.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, who clearly is not an issue, who's clearly not going to be any good at any sort of physical challenge relative to the other people on this show. You get a physical challenge. You outweigh her by at least 25 pounds. You're clearly much stronger. And no thanks. Like, that was some weak stuff.
Yeah. I do. I feel like she may have damaged her standing a little bit in the game with that.
I think she did for sure. Because we're only a season removed from everyone thinking she was a layup to the point where her own boyfriend tried to get her off his team.
Yeah, you know, several times.
Yeah, like being on the winning team because you got to swim before Tori does not suddenly erase the fact that, like, you were considered a liability less than a full season ago.
Yeah.
So, like, to me, she almost put a target on her back. Because if she doesn't want it with that girl, she doesn't want it with anybody.
Right. I do think that you have to go into elimination thing. It's weird. I didn't buy it so much as a twist last week. We talked about it, but you could really see the effect it's had on the game and on the lobbying process. For sure.
I don't know that that twist is the right word because there's different rules every challenge, right? But it's definitely a single rule of this season of the challenge that totally flips the way certain things work on their head. Like, the desire to, the need to go in makes the lobbying and teamwork and alliances all about orchestrating the right opponent as opposed to avoiding going in or whatever else. And
it's going to take some of the, you guys voted me in, I'm so mad at you, I'm so insulted, vibe that has been omnipresent on the show forever, right?
Yes, it'll take some of that, but it's also going to, like, it's going to add a huge stress in that people are going to be forced to call each other out as the weakling they want to fight against. Certainly for the next few weeks, if not all the way through the show.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, they'll get to a point where everybody's strong and it's not going to be, you know, but at least for the next few. Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I think there is an argument that Jenny, like, could have punched a ticket to the finals, right? Because no one wants to put her back in elimination.
No, I mean, I think that's guaranteed. Who's going to want to go against her?
Right.
Dude, look, what was that girl's name? Jen?
Yeah, it was Jenny and Jen.
Jen was pathetic, but the way Jenny smashed her was, I think TJ is right. Maybe some of the guys beat her. Maybe. Not one other girl could have competed with Jenny in that challenge. Not a single other one of those women. And definitely she would have beaten a handful of the guys.
Yeah.
She is just absurdly strong.
She's really strong. Like, there's nobody who has trained, I feel like. You know what I mean? Like, I think you could make a case that, like, Laurel could be that is sort of could play on that strength level. You know what I mean?
Maybe, but that was
and
more
I think Cara Maria has put in the work, but doesn't have the same kind of body. You're right, the frame.
Yeah,
that's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, Laurel is huge. Like Laurel's probably taller and maybe even wider than Jenny, but she was never cut up like that. I mean that girl is ridiculous.
You know who's in this game and not cut, but I think could
there's some
give
strength
Jenny
behind
from
Anissa.
Her money. I was gonna say, and I is it Hattie? Was it?
Oh, Maddie,
the girl from Alabama. Maddie from Alabama.
Maddie is also a thumper, no doubt.
Yeah,
although
she's got some power.
I feel like she was huge power the one season where she was partnered with Kyle, but wasn't she on something else where she really sort of flopped?
I don't know.
It might have been it might have been one of the weird like champs versus pros deals.
Might have been.
She is.
I'd like to see
is,
more of her. She's good TV.
Yeah.
She
had some good ITMs this week, but even you know when Maddie is one of the best ITMs of the week, it's not a great week for that.
Agreed. Yeah, a lot of the key players were off to the side on this one, and that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I mean, maybe we'll get to know more about Swaggy C and Bethany.
Bailey.
Is it Bethany? Bailey. By the way, I feel like Bailey looks different in every single one of the – like every time
they
put her up for one of those ITMs,
correct.
She looks completely different. It's
well,
very disorienting
and,
to
and
me.
And Big T keeps changing wigs and then going bald on us, and like that's disorienting as well.
Yeah.
But I do feel like this was a let's get some TV time for the people who might not be here later episode.
Yeah, I guess so. And look, you got to have those if you're going to do it. Burning one, you know, two episodes in probably isn't the worst. I do feel like they maybe didn't make enough of like is that the greatest route in elimination history? I don't know. Like,
yeah,
it's hard to think of one that went quicker than that.
Well,
I guess CT probably destroyed a couple people like that.
I was going to say, I think of a couple CT eliminations, most notably him carrying Johnny Bananas in the gulag.
Yeah.
I mean, they love to show that replay of like, remember when CT was the craziest beast any of us had ever seen? And yeah, he did some stuff, man. Honestly, the elimination way back on like the Duel 2 when he actually lost, but he lost because he like tore the flag too quickly. Does this ring a bell?
Yeah.
Because he like. It was another one where he just was like screaming and dragging a human being. but yeah, it, certainly in terms of female eliminations, I can't remember a certified beatdown like that one. That was vicious.
Yeah, sure was. Dee blew it, and she knew it.
She did know it.
I have a feeling it's going to come back to haunt her at some point.
How could it not, man? How could it not? Love the challenge.
All right, let's jump into some actual sports. I was going to say real sports, and maybe that's fitting, because this basketball doc, whose name is escaping me all of a sudden, it's terrible.
The Scheme.
The Scheme, thank you.
Yeah.
I enjoyed this, but I feel like if it was like a real sports story, I would have enjoyed it just as much as this sort of two-hour movie.
It was probably too long. And I'm going to – the other sports documentary we're going to talk about, Screwball, like they're very different movies. But I feel like they had one thing in common, which was perhaps the biggest takeaway from both is that our government agencies are idiots run by morons. Who
yeah, it doesn't seem like,
can't get
like
out
there's
of their
a lot of supervision
no.
of some of these undercover workers here, you know.
The undercover workers, the overall planning of all of this stuff from the law enforcement side of it was embarrassing. Like when I think even still at 38 or whatever I am, With my cynicism meter on high and a distrust of the federal government that goes back to at least around the year 2000, Like, I still, when I think FBI, think of a competent organization. When I think of, like, the force of a government agency coming down on criminals, I imagine the government agency has its shit together. And these are two movies about how, not at all, not only do they not have their shit together, they screw everything up at every turn, and at best embarrass themselves, at worst violate their own damn laws. It's yeah. It's insane. And in the scheme in particular, like, every step of the way, the government kicked their own case in the dick.
Yeah. I mean, even just the idea, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Clearly that was entrapment.
And obviously.
And there's a reason. I mean, like, I think the movie wants you to believe that no coaches got implicated criminally because they're coaches and they're rich. But I also think it was because this whole thing was built on a pretty crappy premise.
Yes,
you know?
Because coaches have spent literally 60 years figuring out how to do this thing that they're all doing while violating NCAA rules, but generally not the law.
Right.
And that's violating the whole setup.
Right. And maintaining largely plausible deniability.
Exactly. And so from the very beginning, when this FBI agent is saying, we got to get coaches, we got to get coaches. And everyone's like, that's not how this works. That's not going to happen. It's obvious that the government, rather than try to do something real, which would have involved actually looking at the NCAA's policies and seeing how they allow people to essentially skirt the law and force people to try to skirt the law because of their idiotic, draconian, un-American policies. No, you want to decide the case you're trying to make ahead of time and try to force it square peg, round hole into the actual facts. And it's just, it's so wrong.
It is weird, and you know, they spent a little bit of time talking about the, you know, Southern District of New York, you know, it has this reputation. Obviously, like, you know, if you're watching Billions, you hear a lot about the Southern District of New York, and
yeah,
I almost sort of wonder like why they took on this case. You know, like it just doesn't. It seemed like such a clown show.
Doesn't
they
it
had
make,
to know that, right?
Yeah, it makes me doubt their reputation. It makes me believe that their reputation is nothing more than a circle jerk and yeah. other government people pretending like there's a real thing there. Cause only an incompetent ass would have done this. And by the time they took the case on, they should have known that the FBI agent at the center of it was like on the lam after stealing money.
We don't know that he was on the lam.
You're right. He might have been caught and killed by the FBI for all we know.
Right.
But
he could have just
stole
been,
some
just
money.
Fired or assigned as a desk or
right.
who knows what. But yeah.
Wherever this guy is, he got booted off the case because he stole cash.
Yeah.
So, like, you're building your case. You took on a case that you have to build around a criminal trying to trick people into doing business in an illegal way that they don't normally do.
Yeah.
How could that possibly have seemed like a good idea?
What were there any revelations that sort of surprised you in the film from maybe just from the sports perspective? Because I felt like I had a few.
I mean, not especially. Like, I guess I was a little surprised at how brazen some assistant coaches were willing to be. But then again, they're with this guy that they trust, who's clearly is good at building relationships. And I don't know. This is basically what I thought goes on in college basketball. Like, when the one true thing the government may have said is that they had these guys' playbook. What they left out was the playbook doesn't generally violate federal laws, so I'm not sure what we're doing here.
Yeah. I mean, look, obviously, like, if you say to me, are programs out there, you know, paying $100,000 or more to get college players, I'd be like, of course. if you said to me, is Creighton paying $100,000 or more for players, that surprised me.
Yeah, I guess. You know. But when you talk about these, and I don't know if Creighton is the right example, but like almost all reasonably decent colleges have endowments that would make Bill Gates blush. I mean, it's just, you know, it's worse at private schools, but even any reputable state school has an embarrassing endowment. Like the money that these schools actually have to throw around is almost infinite. So if you're going to be the kind of school that prides itself on basketball, which Creighton certainly does, even though they're not North Carolina, like $100K was not shocking to me. Now, if Creighton was spending $1 million on the whole team, that'd be different. I mean, I feel like you got to be Duke to do that.
Right. Indeed. I also, hearing the coach's audio, and I do like the way they juxtapose it with some of those denials.
Yeah.
There was something visceral about that. Again, the kind of thing that I feel like would have been fine in a real sports story, right, as opposed to a movie form. But like it is a bit of a gut punch when you see that.
Totally. It's visceral. I don't think it was necessarily shocking, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Visceral is exactly the right word. How much do you trust Christian Dawkins as a reliable narrator and all this?
Well, I mean, he's clearly a guy who's trying to get some convictions overturned, but also he seemed honest to me. He definitely said some stuff where he was like, yeah, I did that. Probably shouldn't have done that. You know, like,
yeah.
He did not seem to shy away from a handful of dirtbaggy and or outright illegal activities that he had been a part of. But I think he also had a lot of good points about how ridiculous it is that he's the one and only person who was actually even prosecuted here.
Yeah, that part is definitely true.
I mean, it's just, if I was him, I might have some regrets, but I'd also be livid that, like, this is what happened and this is how it's playing out. Like, come on.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have any idea that the guy at the center of this whole thing was the son of Draymond's high school coach? That was also an interesting revelation.
I did not, but I did like that the one appearance Draymond made was when Christian was like, yeah, so all the way up through JV, I thought I was the shit. Like, I was going pro, and then first practice with Draymond Green, and I was like, oh, no, I need a backup plan.
It's like, it's good.
That's who Draymond is still. That's who he's always been since high school, was the guy who would chase you out of the damn gym if he didn't think you're good enough.
Yep. And, you know, when they show that footage, Draymond, you know, with his game is, I mean, you know, he's one of the best players in the world now. But when he has that and all the physical advantages, like, I can't even imagine.
Ridiculous.
You know?
Just ridiculous.
All right, so Screwball. On to Screwball.
Now, Screwball is the right name for this. And I actually, it was a little shorter and still probably a little too long, but I liked this more so than the scheme, I think. It's bizarre.
It's certainly more entertaining. There was a little bit of Tony Bosch you're talking about?
No, the director.
Oh, I don't know.
He's a well-known documentary director. He did is it Cocaine Cowboys? Billy Corbin.
Ah, nicely done.
But the style, I loved it. It was very weird, but I loved it. The little kids, because what is, and again, the one thing it sort of has in common with the scheme is that the authorities are imbeciles, but I think the essence of this entire story is how absurd it is, right?
Yeah.
And leaning into that with the goofy sort of cut scenes of 10-year-olds playing all the characters and mouthing the lines, I thought it really worked. I mean, it was bizarre, but I thought it really worked.
I feel like there's a little bit of Tiger King in this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In that it's
look at all these psychotic dirtbags, right?
Yep. And like Florida is kind of a character in the story. You know
yeah.
what I mean? Like,
no
this,
doubt.
It feels like a thing that only could happen in Florida, you know?
Maybe specifically only in Miami.
Yeah. And yeah. And it's an entertaining story. And man, A-Rod.
It is
not a good look for A-Rod.
It is not a good look for A-Rod. I guess people don't care, right? Because it's not like this. I mean, this came out last year. It's not like it hurt his ability to be lovable old A-Rod on TV, did it?
I don't think enough people saw it. And I would also say,
well, I mean,
there isn't. I don't know if there's all that much like smoking gun information other than that he, you know, really actively tried to shut down the investigations and some of that stuff. But
well,
like,
I mean, he's got his weird, like, legally questionable cousin doing steroid shopping for him, which we've all known about. He also, everyone knew, like, none of this was all public record for the most part. He sent goons to try to destroy documents. He did the weird face making thing during the like arbitration here. Like the guy is a kook, and on top yeah. of that, he's
the,
a dirtbag.
The paying protest was with pizza.
Yeah, like you can't. That's the it might be the one true thing Tony Bosch says to the camera during this movie is you can't make this shit up, man.
Yeah, indeed.
I mean, it is really crazy stuff, and there were certainly some newish revelations on A-Rod, and just like it's as condensed a packaging of his dirtbaggishness as you can have, and I think that's man, I am guilty of talking about how enjoyable A-Rod is on television. And I don't know
yeah.
if I feel comfortable doing that anymore.
that's kind of what I mean. You know, who knows when there'll be baseball on television again.
Yeah.
But it definitely ruined a little bit of A-Rod for me. I also, and maybe this was really naive, I was also unaware that he was Tanner, you know? Like, I just assumed that that was his natural hue.
A-Rod? Wait, are we sure
yeah.
A-Rod's a Tanner?
Yeah, I believe that was in there.
Huh. Okay. I don't remember that. But he's definitely intimately involved with Tanners. There's no question about that. And honestly, all the characters, like not just the famous people, this Porter Robinson guy is unbelievable.
Tremendous.
He's still, and like, after all of this, he's still so naive about the whole thing. It's remarkable.
Yeah. I thought the reporter from the New Times was also really good.
Really like, great.
Yeah.
No, I mean, this was a like a well-conceived, you know, interestingly dramatized documentary. Like, I thought it was really well done.
Did you remember the Pedro Gomez, Tony Bosch drunken interview? I did
no.
not. But, man, that was great.
Yeah, well, and yeah, it's so funny too. If only I watched this what Tuesday night I think, and we had just talked to Pedro, like that day on the show, and then I watched the movie. And I was like, oh God, why didn't I watch this last
yeah.
night? Because, man, it's his position is very awkward. But I thought he did a nice job of talking about what he was trying to do and like sort of where his head was at because. Watching it, and I also didn't remember it, but watching it, my thought was, like, if I didn't know what was happening here, I'd be like, what is wrong with Pedro? Why is
yeah.
he? What's happening here?
It's weird because, you know, I just remember him as the guy that ESPN paid to follow around Barry Bonds
right.
for.
Exactly.
I always sort of thought of him as a West Coast guy, you know.
He's an Arizona guy.
Apparently, he's got deep Miami ties, though, right? He knew
well,
Bosch
right.
From...
He lives in Arizona, I should say. He's a huge baseball wonk, and he lives in Arizona. But yeah, he's obviously a Miami Cuban community dude.
Yeah. Well, Screwball's a fun movie. It's worth going back to watch, and it's, you know, I mean, especially nowadays, if you want to kill an hour and a half on a Saturday, it goes
Yeah,
fast.
Exactly. It's a really – and especially if, like, you know, even if you've watched a lot of – it's a very different documentary, and it's very upbeat, for lack of a better word.
Yes. Yeah. Like, it's lighthearted, which is a nice change of pace from some of the docs that, you know, if you've been watching a lot of true crime.
Right.
Here's one that's got some crime.
Yeah.
It's very low stakes, though, on the crime front.
That's exactly right. Like, everything's pretty low stakes crime-wise. I mean, there's a lot of money at hand, but no one's getting seriously hurt for the most part, and it's just an unbelievable, insane story.
Yep, and oddly adorable.
Oddly adorable, although that might have been the 10-year-olds.
Yeah, it's a lot about the 10-year-olds with fake tattoo sleeves.
Yeah, did you stay tuned for the gag reel of 10-year-olds making each other laugh?
No, I think I missed that.
Oh,
no.
It's almost worth going back to watch the credits just to watch it. It's charming, if nothing else.
I might check that out. All right, did you have time to catch the end of the tour?
I sure did.
I really had fun with this one.
Yeah, this is. I was gonna say my, but I think this is our kind of movie.
Yeah,
I think this movie is for a relatively limited audience. Like, you got to be the kind of person who the log line appeals to, and the log line is basically two really smart dudes talk about writing and life.
Yep.
And that's all that happens in the entire movie. That's the whole movie.
A gummer shows up, which is another clue that it's probably our kind of movie.
That's true. Love a gummer. Everybody loves a gummer. But it's really just really convincing performances by two really good young actors as smart men talking.
Yep.
And they talk about so many interesting things. And a lot of it's literary, but a lot of it is just life stuff that I would think anyone could relate to. So if watching dudes talk appeals to you, you're going to love this movie, because this is some of the best talk you'll ever watch.
I think there was some really great stuff too about just sort of the creative process.
Yeah.
And you know, what it means to sort of represent yourself in art.
And to represent yourself in the world, and to socialize,
and how those things can conflict, and
creativity, depression, you know, writing, love, all of these things are discussed in one way or another. And again, I found the Jason Segel performance like deeply moving and authentic.
Yeah, it kind of made me wonder why it was so slept on at the time.
I think
people couldn't wrap their heads around him playing that guy, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe, but I think also, like, it was pretty well received by critics. I think it's just a movie for a small number of people, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I really think that's what it comes down to, but certainly, if David Foster Wallace is of interest to you at all, I think this would be an excellent watch.
Have you read Infinite Jest?
No, I don't have that kind of time self motivation.
I really would like to, someday, but like it's just not a realistic thing to even start to undertake at this point, right?
That feels like my mom. These days sometimes takes like a literature course at Northwestern, just you know, like a continuing education sort of thing, like so she'll read like Ulysses or something. So like when I'm in my 60s, I figure I can like go to a local community college and have someone help me through Infinite Jest.
Yeah, that seems like a good idea. By the way, this movie also a very good low-key Minneapolis road movie. Yeah, a lot of good Minneapolis, and like definitely shot here. A lot of places that I could easily, very easily pick out, many of which were not far from my house. So that was
that's fun.
Kind of neat to see as well. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is an enthusiastic two thumbs up from me, with the caveat that it's very specific.
Yeah, you got to like those kind of things. I don't know that I would just recommend it to a rando, but
right.
If you listen this far on the podcast, it's probably for you.
It's probably true. If you're still with us on episode 208, I'm thinking maybe this is your kind of thing as well.
Yeah, indeed. This is, I guess, now the part where I should apologize that I did not watch Sucker Free City.
Yeah, apologize to the people. Although I have to tell you, this was intense, and there's a ton of depth to it, and some really good performances from actors you know and love when they were much younger than they are now, and it's also infuriatingly piloty.
Yeah, for a thing that was there were no more episodes made of,
and that's the problem. This is like, it's a 2-hour study in what might have been. Because I think this could have been an incredible, you know, Wire-esque story. It's multiple communities in multiple neighborhoods. It's dealing with policing and gentrification and racial dynamics in a city where race is a really interesting thing, San Francisco specifically.
Yeah. Well, and gentrification's on steroids.
That's right. This, if Spike Lee had gotten to make this whole show, I think we would talk about it like we talk about The Wire, only about San Francisco. And I think people would cite it when they talk about how San Francisco has changed so dramatically. Not just from, you know, 96 to 06 or whenever this was made, but from then to now. And it's just,
yeah.
I just felt the whole time like it's a damn shame that Spike Lee, for whatever reason, didn't make this series.
I'm not entirely sure Spike was ready for series television in 2005. I think
but
might be part of it.
But in retrospect, like, it would have been a good move.
Yeah,
he would have been at the tip of the spear of the TV revolution. And again, like, there's just no doubt, like, this was the right story and his were the right hands to tell about San Francisco. And it's just a bummer to me that it didn't happen.
Yeah. And I think he wound up pouring a lot of that energy into the Fort Greene story that is She's Gotta Have It on Netflix now.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah. Definitely different tone, however, on that show than...
Yeah. No, I mean, this is very, very Wire-esque. I mean, it really feels like The Wire, only more community-based than any specific police basis. But policing was certainly a part of the story they were telling. And man,
I would
like,
bet you that's how it got pitched to Showtime, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it could have been great. I don't know what happened, but it's a bit of a bummer. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, I don't not recommend it, but I also kind of don't recommend it because it leaves you wanting a series that never happened.
Also, tough to find, unless you're, like, just down to watch full movies on YouTube, which
or,
is not normal.
Or, you know, you could
I
rent
do.
It on Amazon, but it's probably
I could not rent it on Amazon. I would have spent the
really?
Money to do that. I'd have that option, yeah.
Huh.
So
I thought we found that you could, but who knows?
I actually looked it up when we were doing it last week, and then I couldn't find it again this week. So,
well, there you go. Now, did you forget that we were going to talk about the end of Ozark?
I did not.
Okay, you were saving it for last.
I was saving it for last.
I'm glad you did that. I think I said that this show, I wasn't sure it was anything different than it was when it started. And I guess, I don't know if I still feel that way, but here's what I can tell you. The final episode of season 3 of Ozark, maybe the final 2 episodes, is about as good as you can make an episode or two of TV in my book.
Oh, wow. That's
especially
that is really high praise.
Especially the last one. I mean, look, there are certain things this show isn't doing and can't do. And, you know, since we were just talking about The Wire, like, it's not that. There's no the depth of it is not that.
Right. It's to me, it's a bit genre still. You know
maybe,
what I mean?
But like that.
It's really high level.
Oh, it's so high level. And I thought the last episode or two was up there with some of the best, like, Breaking Bad episodes, for instance. Like,
yeah, see, to me, like, I like. See, now I am now in the position of I don't think it's Breaking Bad level television from a quality standpoint. But it's close. I think it's close.
I guess I'm saying from an execution standpoint.
From a plot execution standpoint, maybe that's maybe what I would say.
Right, you're right. It's not. I don't mean like it's not the same level of art as those shows.
Yeah,
but it's the same level of TV. Is that fair?
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. And I don't want to parse that too much because Ozark is so enjoyable.
Oh man,
you know.
And those last two episodes, the tension that they built. And I'm going to spoil this massively, so you're going to want to skip ahead if you have not finished season 3 of Ozark. But the tension that builds all the way to the literal last seconds of the finale episode, and he just walks up and shoots Helen in the fucking face. Oh, man. Like, that is as much tension built up to a sudden release and then cut to black. Like... That was awesome.
Did you watch like Melrose Place when you were younger? I think you said you were a little too old for that or young for that, right?
A little too young for Melrose Place and 90210. Yeah.
There's a famous moment in Melrose Place, and maybe you've heard someone talk about this, where like one of the characters reveals that she has like a brain surgery, and she like whips off this wig to reveal this like massive scar.
Oh man!
No. It was one of those moments that like. Everybody who watched the show remembers because it was just like, ah, holy fuck. And like, I don't know that I have had that kind of visceral, like, holy shit reaction to something on television until the very end of this. And that is the main reason why I was like, why don't you finish it? Let's talk about it.
It was one of the most shocking, and to just end it there, like, because that's sort of what I was getting at the beginning of this conversation is, I don't know that we know what this show is anymore, because with one gunshot, the entire arrangement as we understood it is gone.
Right. But this show has done that sort of thing before, turned arrangements on its head. I mean, I think you know what it is, right?
Well, no, I mean, we know. I think, and that's why it's not the art that some of those other shows are.
The noose is going to tighten around Marty and Wendy. Like, that's
right.
What next season is going to be.
That's right.
A question of how that happens. You know what I mean?
Well, that's exactly it. And so that's why I sort of pulled back that maybe I still do know basically what this show is, but. Like, it flips the framework very dramatically. And it also, it's a way of, in one split second, releasing all of this incredible tension you've built up in this last episode or two of this season and wrapping up this season in, like, a really satisfactory way and also opening a door to a whole set of new possibilities.
Yeah. And I think much like Breaking Bad, although there's another thing I think maybe Breaking Bad did like a little bit better. You have so many of these great moments where these characters who've now built up a fair amount of goodwill with us over three seasons, where they just dunk on people.
Yeah.
And deliver these like monologues that are just like gut punch, you know?
Yeah. Is it Julia Garner who plays Ruth?
Yeah.
She's just tremendous.
She is. She's good in everything. Yeah, she's that girl can act. Shout out to The Americans, by the way, where she had a really awesome turn for a couple seasons as well.
Yeah.
No
relation
but
to James, as far as I can tell.
I don't believe she's related to James. She's great. And like you said, I know you're not the biggest Laura Linney fan, but you know, Laura has a few moments too.
Yes, she does.
You know, when she and Helen, when they are bilking those four hapless casino owners.
I know.
Like...
And also just like, I got to say, almost every scene with just Jason Bateman and Laura Linney, you know, for a relationship that I think we're essentially supposed to hate, they do a really good job of playing it.
Yeah. No, they play the nuances really well. And the kids, I think the kids have become pretty interesting characters in their own right when they were certainly seen to just be sort of be plot appendages at the start of season one.
Two fun facts about Julia Garner. She's married to Mark Foster of Foster the People.
Oh.
And she also is the daughter of an Israeli comedian who is now a therapist in the Bronx.
Okay.
Her mother had a successful career as a comedian in her native Israel and is now a therapist in the Bronx.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Those are things I would not necessarily
great
have guessed.
Great Jews of Hollywood. Julia Garner in the club.
Julia Garner, I had not pinned down as a member of the tribe.
No, good for her.
I also want to mention the, and I don't know the actor's name, but the scene with Ben in the cab.
Yes. Well, he's the guy from, he was in Iron Fist.
I have not seen Iron Fist.
That's probably probably better for you.
Yeah. But wow, that I really thought that was I thought he did some really tremendous work, and that's a character that could have easily gone sideways.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
Yeah, what a show.
Huh. Tom Pelfrey is that actor's name.
All right.
Tom Pelfrey. He was Ward Meacham in Iron Fist.
The other thing about Ozark is like it. If you just want to watch it as popcorn, you know what I mean, and like not even pay that much attention to it, it's a thrill a minute.
No question. It's great TV. It's great TV, and like I'm saying, it may not rise to the artistic level of the greatest shows of our lifetime, but it's as enjoyable as anything.
Yeah, it's also not trying to. You know what I mean?
Like, no, it's exactly – it's batting 1,000 on what it's attempting to do.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so we should probably jump to homework here because
yes,
I feel like we're getting under time.
We're running pretty long, man.
So there were a couple of other things that I remembered were coming out next week that we didn't talk about in our little pre-show homework meeting. So I'm going to just throw a few at the end, and maybe we'll pick two. Okay, so Killing Eve's coming back. That's a definite. We're going to do that one, right?
Yep.
Insecure is coming back. That is also a definite.
Yep.
I think we're definite on Run, which is the Merritt Weaver, Domhnall Gleeson show on HBO coming up after Insecure.
Definitely.
And I've heard some good things initially about reviews on that.
I'm in. Merritt right. Weaver, I'm in.
Yeah, exactly. Merritt Weaver does not let you down. All right, so those three are definites. And I think we got to pick two out of the next four.
Oh, my.
All right. So we got Mrs. America. I'm high on this one. This is Cate Blanchett and a lot of other famous people. Sarah Paulson and I don't know. We went through the whole list last week.
Yes.
I believe character actress Margot Martindale, I think, makes an appearance in there somewhere, too.
I feel like you said that, yeah.
Yeah. But it's about the passage of the Equal Rights – or not passage because it didn't pass. The attempted passage of the Equal Rights Amendment in the 60s. It's supposed to be really, really good. So I'm high on that one.
Blanchett, Rose Byrne, Sarah Paulson, character actress Margot Martindale, Uzo Adoba of Orange is the New Black, Elizabeth Banks, Tracy Ullman, and John Slattery, although I don't know why they put a man on this list.
There's probably a man in there somewhere. Yeah.
Could have left him off the list.
I mean, look, you got John Snyder playing a 60s guy. Like, I mean, come on.
It's worked before, folks.
All right. So that's one. Then there's 000, which is a cocaine running drama on Amazon Prime, starring Gabriel Byrne and some others. The two that I didn't mention when we were doing the meeting, Tiger Tail, which is the Alan Yang, who is the creative guy behind Master of None. He has made a dramatic movie that's airing on Netflix based on some of the experiences of his family, who is Taiwanese.
Huh.
It's supposed to be pretty good.
Sounds pretty heavy.
Yeah, I think it might be a little bit heavy.
Okay.
And then the other one is Bruise Brothers, which is produced in part by Jeff Schaefer of The League, and it's basically supposed to be like The League, but if it was microbreweries instead of fantasy football.
Oh. Well, I think I would choose Mrs. America and Bruise Brothers, given the option.
Okay, I can roll with that.
Who's in Bruise Brothers?
I don't think there are a lot of famous people from what I read.
Let's see. Oh, yeah, nobody I recognize.
Yeah. But I will say Jeff Schaefer also just did played a big part on the last season of Curb, which I know you don't watch, but as Curb seasons go, was a very strong one.
I've heard that. Yeah, let's do Bruise Brothers. I like it.
All right, so we'll do that, and that's on Netflix.
So we got Killing Eve, Insecure, Run, Mrs. America, and Bruise Brothers, plus, of course, new episodes of Top Chef and The Challenge.
Yeah, it's going to be another super-sized episode, I got a feeling.
Can't wait. I'm off to watch some TV. Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.